Okay, thank you for coming tonight. Tony, if you want to check this camera, I wouldn't mind you taking a look at this camera, too. I know you can't do everything. All right. Hey, thank you for coming tonight. I hope this works. This is our last night of Greek. Next week, we will be in Romans and going through the book of Romans in one night. I want to promise that. And then we'll go through 1 Corinthians the following week, and we'll continue to go through the New Testament, one book or maybe a couple books a night as we go. I did want to point this out. I just thought it'd be interesting to see this. These are some emails we've gotten in the last 2 weeks, probably, from around the world. We've got a couple from Romania wanting books. There's an interesting one there in concerning the Philippines about a Bible school that is using our books. We shipped those out probably at least 6 weeks ago. We shipped them into the States, and they're shipping them down to the Philippines and starting a Bible school. They had a Bible school, it appears, and the expenses got out of hand, but with the framework book, they can start up again. Also, we've had some from Pakistan. I've been getting some videos from Pakistan. A guy's doing a church there, and he's uploading some videos and sending them out. I should put those on Facebook or something. Of course, Nigeria. And then gotten one from North Ireland, I think it was yesterday, and then the Czech Republic, first time we've got anything from there. An interesting email from Spain. An engineer is writing a book about tunneling and wanted to use some of the photos we took that are in the Jerusalem book, use them in his book, which I thought was kind of neat. It's kind of like kinda getting out of my area of expertise in that. But anyway, just some interesting things there if you take a look at on what's going on. We are in Greek here in framework tonight. We're going to review a little bit about what we talked last week, talk a little bit about the verbs, and just kind of show you. I don't expect you to memorize or even wrap your mind around everything, but at least kind of get an introduction to it. And then the main thing, guys, I'm going to show you some books and some simple study tools that are available, starting with simply with a concordance, and then you can go all the way into, there's a set called Kittles, it's a 10-volume set that gets into some great detail. I'll show you some of those things there. So let's open up to the Greek sections here, which begins on page... let's just open up to let's go to page 331. And I do want to point this out. We talked a little bit about the development of the Greek language, how Alexander the Great kind of brought it together when he was conquering the world, brought the different dialects and spread it around the Middle East, kind of became the language of the world, Koine Greek, of what we use or in the New Testament, we found out, is actually the common Greek that was spoken in the streets. It was used for business. It would have been the language of the streets or the newspapers, the common Greek. With the discovery of the Oxyrhynchos papyri in Egypt at the turn of the century, late 1800s, early 1900s, all the papyri brought to light a lot of the Greek language. Many of them were discovered, papyri written on the paper of the day from the actual days of the New Testament, of the Apostle Paul, a tax receipt from 66 AD, for example. And that really brought to light the English or the Greek language, showing us that it was actually just a very common language, wasn't a mystical language, and brought into some real meaning to the words. The meaning of the words used by the people who were writing them. In other words, you know how English words can change over years. How you wrote the King James Bible, many times there's words that are used in the King James that if you read the King James today, those words don't mean exactly what they meant back 400 years ago. And so, same thing happened with the Greek language. The way Homer used the Greek word doesn't mean that's the way it was used in the days of the New Testament, or the way it was used in the early church, days of Constantine or something like this, doesn't mean that's what it was used for in 300 or in 60 AD. And so, finding these Oxyrhynchos papyri really helped us see what those words really meant. And it's kind of scary when you see people start teaching Greek, including myself, and they start saying, when Homer said this word, this is what he was saying. But that's like saying, when Abraham Lincoln said this word, this is what it meant. I mean, the words have changed. We still can read English, but the words have changed meaning, or they've evolved. And that leads us to our last comment on page 332. I read this. One of the great scholars, A.C. Robertson, one of the great Greek scholars, says the problem with this is...
someone said this, it might seem to encourage the charlatan and the quack. It is possible for the ignoramus to make a parade of a little lumber of learning to the disgust and confusion of his hearers. And that applies to myself and applies to anyone who just starts dabbling in the Greek thinking they found something, and they start grabbing different meanings from different time periods or misusing the little knowledge that they've got. And indeed, that is the place I'm in. I'm just trying to lead you to, seriously, I'm trying to lead you to guys like Wiest. And Robertson himself, guys that are actually Greek scholars, showing this is what they wrote. And to do that, we need to know a little bit about the Greek language, a little bit about the alphabet. So that's kind of what I'm doing, not trying to stand up here and flaunt I'm a Greek scholar, which I'm not, but I did buy some Greek books. Page 333, you've got your alphabet. The letters you want to learn there are those minuscule, as you can see right there. There's a practice page there on the next where you can write them, like the alpha, the beta, the gamma, the delta, the epsilon, the zeta, eta, theta, the Easter egg look. And again, those are the first few letters. Some of these are going to be simple to remember. B for beta, D as in delta, epsilon is the E. Things like the gamma looks like a Y, but it's the G sound. The Easter egg, what is that? The theta, that is the TH sound. So here's an example of where we don't have anything in the English language. Here is the... For example, just running this through, not trying to have you memorize this. The short A, alpha. Here would be a long A, eta. And so this is the alpha and the eta letters. And so, again, that's what you can see on that page there, the different letters as we go through. It's nice to learn those letters. It takes a little bit of effort so that you can sound out words. It just helps you move through it. It'd be like trying to find your way through an English dictionary, and I have this problem, and not knowing the order of the alphabet. Of course, I know the order of the alphabet. I can say my ABCs, but you start getting around the U and the S and the T. It's like, I've got to go back and go, LMNOPQRST. I still have to do that. I'm not sure if you've got a photographic memory. You just like, you can see the letters. I've got to say the little rhyme to find out where I'm at in the dictionary. And the same thing is true in the Greek, but just imagine not being able to recognize letters. Or imagine being able to recognize letters and actually repeat the Greek alphabet in your head and be able to find and navigate your way through a simple Greek dictionary. Page 334, you can practice making your letters. I suggest if you care, just make some photocopies of that. You can practice writing the letters. You can see the alpha, the beta, the gamma. And you've got the English equivalent. That's called the transliteration. Two different words there. Translation is where we take the meaning of the Greek word and bring it over into an English word that's translating it. For example, agape means love. Agape would be, or could be here, agape, that's Greek. Translated, it means love. Transliterated would be A-G-A-P-E. Agape. And so some of these books we look at, what we'd say the hardcore Greek books, they just stay right here in the Greek, deal with it. But some of them, like Wiest and other people, there's no Greek in them. They use Greek, they talk about Greek, but everything has been transliterated. And so this is agape, that's agape. This is the English transliteration of agape in the Greek, for example. And this would be the translation. It's a completely different word. This is love. This is, of course, the English word for love. And, for example, in the King James, they translated the word agape. You know how they translate agape? They translated it what? Do you know? I mean, you do know. Charity. Remember that? In the King James, charity is how they translate it. Because that's what charity meant back in 1611. Charity meant love. Today, charity means, you know, something you drop off at the door, you give when you come into a store during Christmas season. Okay. Anyway, those are the letters. Here's some practices on page 336 and 337. Practice saying them and going through that. The Greek vocabulary is on page 338. We're going to look at a word tonight out of Ephesians 4 that is used one time in the Greek New Testament. For example, on page 338, you've got a list of words that are used 500 times in the Greek New Testament. So if you begin building your vocabulary, you probably don't want to start with this one word that you only see once in the Greek New Testament. If you start using these 500, working on these 500 words that are used 500 times, you can hardly get through a verse in the New Testament without bumping into one of these words. And so, or at least a chapter. And so it makes it a little more productive of memorizing some words or learning some words, or at least becoming familiar with them. Again, we're talking about being familiar with them. Page 341, we're talking about transliteration. We practice transliteration. That first word on page 341, anthropos, you should write that out, for example. Anthropos. That would be the transliteration of the Greek word that you see written there. Page 342. Some more, 343. We mentioned last week the different classes of if. First, second, third, fourth classes of if, and how they mean different things and their meaning. For example, on page 345, you've got their list of the three different classes of Greek. Those first two pages kind of explain it to you, but when the if comes up in the English Bible, it can, and a lot of times it's captured in the translation, but it can go four different directions. And for example, the first class is the class of reality. If, and I know it to be true. For example, when Satan says to Jesus, if you are the Son of God, he wasn't like, we don't know, I wonder if you are. If you are, and we know you are the Son of God, turn these stones to bread. That is the first class condition. The second class is the unreality. If you will, but I know you won't. And unknown is kind of the way we use it. When I think of the word if in English, I think of the third class condition. If maybe you will, maybe you won't. If you show up. And sometimes it means that if you confess your sins. You know, maybe you will, maybe you won't. But if you do, this is the result. Unlikely, and that's the fourth class condition. If, I wish it were true, but it is not. And there's some examples of it written over there on the right side. The preposition, there's a little preposition chart on the next page. Showing you what's kind of neat there, if you really get into this, it's nice to have a little chart like that hanging on the wall somewhere. You just turn and look at the word, and you get a mental picture of these words. So you see like the word dia, and we mentioned this last week too, dia, like diameter, it means, here's your box, it means to go through the box, through, dia, like through the circle, diameter. And these are just some prepositions that we even carry over into the English language, many of these. The Greek nouns, we talked about the endings of them. There's five classes, the nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, and vocative. And they all have, like, you know, if it's the subject of the sentence, if it's the direct object of the sentence. And that's all in the ending of the words. You can see the ending of the words may be the omicron sigma or the omicron nu. They all will mean how that word ends will determine where it goes in the sentence. And, of course, that's important and will be referred to. Greek verbs, I think this is about where we left off last week. The Greek verbs. And the main thing that I've got this chapter for is we can go through it and study it. But the idea here, if you have this chapter, have it marked or something, and you start getting into these books, I'll show you different places where it will tell you this verb is in the imperfect tense, or it is the aorist tense. And it's like, what does that mean? Well, it means this. And a lot of times the Greek scholars will say, well, this is in the aorist tense. And it's like, well, so? Well, that means something. You can see right here. Let's read through these very quickly, if you don't mind. There are here the imperfect tense. This conveys continuous or repeated action in past time. We're on page 349. I don't expect you to memorize this. I'm going to just shoot it at you so you see what's on this page and you can refer to it later. But if it's in the imperfect tense, it's saying that the action of the verb is continuous or repeated and it took place in the past somewhere. That would be the imperfect tense. It is the action that has occurred more than once. For example, Mark 5:18 talks about they was entreating. You know, like sometimes the demon or is crying out, was saying something, or the person is crying out, the woman was pleading, and it happened in the past continuously, repeated action. It also conveys habitual or customary action. Every day I used to sit in the temple teaching. Jesus said that in Matthew 26:55. Every day I used to sit. That was in the imperfect tense, meaning that was a habitual practice. I sat in the temple teaching publicly. I wasn't hiding somewhere or teaching some secret doctrine. I was in the temple. I was in the teaching center of Israel, teaching daily, habitually. What is your complaint? What do you want to know? Why are you questioning me? You've heard me teach. Many of you sat there and listened and scoffed in the background. I was there habitually. That would be the imperfect tense. The aorist tense conveys a point of action in the past. Notice a point of action. The action is viewed as a completed whole or a one-time action. This is determined by the text. And he got different things, different examples here. Effective or successful action, as in 1 Timothy 1:3. You may instruct certain men. Effectively, you may effectively at a point in the past do this. And I've got other examples written there that you can see. Perfect tense conveys completed action in the past with finished results still abiding in the present. Now that's kind of exciting. A completed action in the past with finished results still abiding in the present. So something happened in the past, it's done and finished, but we're still living with those results today. Indicates that a past event is now complete or it has continuing effect or consequences. Ephesians 2:8 and 9. For by grace are you saved, which means for by grace you have been saved in the past with the result that you keep on being saved forever. I mean, right there, my friends, again, that whole debate, eternal security, can you lose your salvation? I mean, I'm not, you know, yes, you can pick different verses and try and, you know, make the argument. But here, for example, is one verse that would be used by those who believe in the eternal security. For example, let me read it to you again. It means completed action in the past with finished results still abiding in the future, which means, for by grace are you saved. You are saved in the past, and the results continue into the future. I mean, there's, you can make your argument simply from the verb tense. You say, well, I don't know. People would say, that's awful deep. That's awful confusing. Does God really want us doing that? Do you remember Jesus arguing with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and the Herodians on the last week? I think it was like on Tuesday, the last week of his ministry. When they came to ask him all kinds of questions. Who should we pay our taxes or should we not? Should we do this or should we not? They came to the Sadducees, came and said, there was this man that was married to this woman and he died, so she married his brother. Then he died and she married his other brother, married all seven brothers, until finally she died and they're all in heaven. In heaven, whose wife is she? He says, you're in error because you do not know the power of God or the Scriptures. And he goes on and he makes this quote. He says, Abraham, when God appeared to Moses, he says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he rested his argument on that. He said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. When he says, I am, he was talking to Moses in 1400 A.B.C. about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who lived 2000 to 1800 B.C., some, you know, 600 years before. And he says, after they've been dead for some 600 years or 400 years, he still says to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. In other words, he should have said, according to the Sadducees, I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But God says, I am, which means he's still their God. They still exist. They still have a relationship that he can be called their God. So, I mean, understand, not to make a big point about this, but a lot of these theological discussions, a lot of an understanding comes down to the tense of the verb. Should we mess with it? Well, Jesus did. He shut the Sadducees down by saying, Moses was told, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What was the point? They're not dead. They're not on earth any longer, but they still exist. Remember, the Sadducees did not believe in life after death. They didn't believe in the resurrection. And that verse right there, the tense of that verb, in Jesus' mind, it destroyed their whole theological basis. I am. Should be I was. Okay. Anyway, that's the perfect tense. There's other examples you can see there. We go on to page 2350. The pluperfect tense conveys completed action in the past with finished results in the past. John 19:22. What I have written, I have written. I wrote in the past, and the results are done in the past. That's it. We're not going back to it. Present tense conveys continuous or habitual action. And that is something you kind of want to remember. The present tense is something you kind of want to remember. Many verses will have this in there. The action that occurs or happens over and over again, as in Matthew 10:1, to repeatedly cast them out or to over and over heal every kind of disease. So when Jesus was going about healing every disease and casting out the demons, he was doing it over and over and over and over again. He just wouldn't stop. Yeah, a continuous habitual action again. And future tense, action planned for a future time. And then there's an example of John 3:36. They shall not see life. That is in the future. They have life now, but in the future they shall not see life someday in the future. And so now listen, every verb has tense, voice, and mood. Now this is why this can become very exciting, and of course I'm just throwing it out at you, but you can see how you'd like to spend, if you're interested, weeks studying this and learning this, because every verb, pow, explodes in the Greek. And here it goes, 6 different tenses are available. Then you go to the voice, and that's the next thing. It expresses the relationship between the subject of the verb and the verb's action. And this is basic. You've got active, you've got passive, and you've got middle voice. And this, of course, is also useful because, well, here we go, active. The subject causes or produces the action of the verb. If the verb is in the active sense, the subject of the sentence is doing the verb. If it is in the passive voice, the subject of the sentence, well, let's read it right here. The subject receives the action. It's underneath C, the first point under C. The subject is receiving the action. Sometimes in the English, it's just kind of hanging there. The subject of the sentence and the verb are all together. But when you find out if it's active or passive, you find out if that subject of the sentence is actually doing it, or if the subject of the sentence is having it done to them. You know, they shall receive life. Are they causing that life to come to themselves, or are they passively receiving life from somewhere else? And again, you can understand possibly how certain theological debates can hinge on if it's passive or active. Where's the action coming? Is God causing the action, or are people causing the action, or is Satan causing the action, just for example? And then the middle voice, the subject is involved in the action, most often in the interest of the subject itself. And it's interesting. Well, let's see, we got John 15:16. You have not chosen me, but I have chosen you. Again, there's an example of the subject God choosing, and the reason he chose was for his own purpose. It was like, this was my idea. And there's your active, middle, and passive voice. And then you get into mood. Refers, that's the third thing right here. The mood. That refers to the manner in which an action is conceived by the speaker. Notice what it says. As it conceived by the speaker. This is the speaker. This is coming out of the speaker's mind, the way they perceived it. Now, of course, if it's the Word of God, it's inspired, we would assume it's true. But they could have someone saying something, like the Pharisees could say something, and from their perspective, this is how they perceived it. They conceived it this way. But so that keeps in mind. There are four moods. The indicative mood is the mood of reality, indicates that the verb really happened, at least in the mind of the speaker. John 1:1, in the beginning was the Word. That is the mood of reality. So you can have the tense, you know, perfect or past tense or future, the voice telling if it's active, middle, or passive, but also now, what are they saying? Are they saying that this is a reality? I mean, it's going to depend on how you translate. This is really in the beginning was the Word. The subjunctive mood, the mood of potential, meaning it could happen, indicates that the verb could potentially happen, as in John 14:31, come now, let us leave. So when that is said, come now, let us leave, it's like, this is not a reality. This is what we're going to attempt to do. It's potential. We are going to leave. Come, let's begin trying to leave. Jesus died, number three. Jesus, or point three under B, under the subjunctive. Jesus died. It's written in the indicative mood, that all might, subjunctive mood, be saved. Remember, the subjunctive mood is the mood of potential. And so, that all might be saved. Potential, in that verb, potentially, all could be saved. That's interesting, especially with some of the study I'm working on right now. Jesus died, indicative, is again, the mood of reality. Jesus really died. In the mind of the speaker, Jesus really died. But also in the mind of the speaker, the reason he died was that the potential would be created that all could be saved. And that is the subjunctive mood. Imperative mood is the mood of command, which is really interesting when you start reading when Paul writes to Timothy or something like this. What do we got? 1 Corinthians 11:24. It's the verb, it's the imperative mood is the voice of command. Do this in remembrance of me. When Jesus says this, as Paul records the communion, do this in remembrance of me, he is saying it not as potentially you should consider doing this, or in reality you do this. He is saying, do this in remembrance of me as a command. Do this in remembrance of me. And the optative mood is the mood of expressing a wish or desire. As in 2 Thessalonians 3:5, may the Lord direct your hearts into God's love and Christ's perseverance. Again, that's the mood of not a command. He's not commanding God do this. He's not saying God has done this. He's not saying there is potential for this. He's saying this is what I wish to happen. And so that is all in the mood. You can see in each verb will have this listed with it in certain books. And again, it means nothing until you look at it. And again, even then, if you don't use it every day and think about it often, it's you forget how it means. That's why a chart like, you forget what it means. That's why something like this is useful. The next thing listed on page 351, the present imperative. When you make certain combinations, when you make certain combinations of the tense and the voice, or different combinations of them, they take on unique positions or unique meanings. And here's a few of them. The present imperative, the aorist imperative, the negative present imperative. Just some things we're not going to go through those. But understand, some of them, when it says these things together, they create their own special identity, own special meaning. So keep that in mind. I'm going to ask if there's any questions at that point. Was that even useful to know that? Okay, I mean, it's there. It's there. And again, these three things are in the verb. Now again, understand the difference between a verb and a noun. A noun does not include the noun. It includes the action of the sentence. And so, a lot of things are happening in those words. And once again, I know some of you mentioned this last week after class, is when someone is translating the Bible, how much they've got to be looking at. Things are happening in those verses. You can't just take a simple translation. And that's also why sometimes a word-for-word translation just doesn't cut it. Because a word-for-word translation sometimes is going to miss some of those things. They've got to add things in there, you know, I wish that you would, or different things. That's not in the Greek. No, it's not. There's not a word that says that, but it's within the verb itself. Questions at all?
Really important to go to the original scripture, because like there are hundreds and hundreds of translations in the world.
Right.
You cannot really get what it means. You really need to be careful.
Or you again. This is why again. I apologize if someone's sold on the King James only or something. But that's why also it's important to have several different translations, because to make people they want the Bible to read fluently. They want it to read to make sense, and not to be this heavy, cumbersome. How do you say cumbersome book that you've got? Like if you ever read like the Amplified, anybody ever read the Amplified Bible? That's a good Bible, but it's like, man, it's like it tries to capture everything in the sentence, and so that's why it's nice to have different translations, kind of overread them, or like you say, go back to the Greek. And for example, I got some books coming here now. For example, we've got right here is your Greek New Testament right here. But the problem with that is I can't read Greek, I'm stumbling trying to get through this. So then you're going to get right here an interlinear that's got the Greek, but it's also got the English translation underneath it. But once again, it's a translation trying to capture it. And so what you need to do kind of sometimes is go through these books and sift through them and find out the different potential. And let me say this too. You need to be careful, and I've seen people do this, and I've done it myself too, is that you get a little bit of this information, you go find a verb, you say, oh, this is what this word means, it's got this potential, but there may be some special language law in the Greek language that sends it one way or the other way, and not knowing that, you start preaching something, and it's like, it's not even, there's Greek rules why that's not true, but it appears in a simpler form. So again, there is levels of understanding this Greek language as in anything. Good comment. Yes, sir.
So how do they write these different tenses of these verbs? Is it with different letters?
It's the ending. Yeah, right. Yeah, the different endings at the end of the sentence. Or end of the word. Okay. The endings. Yep. Okay. Now here's what I wanted to get into tonight. And that is on page 353. Some Greek study tools. A lot of that right there that we've gone through is reference material, it's introductory material. This is kind of, if you're interested, again, there's several layers that you could get into this. I would think you, and most of you probably do, you should at least have a concordance, because then that's very useful. But from there on, you could keep going further and further, all the way to the places, like I said, you've got an actual Greek New Testament, which is virtually useless for me, except I can look up the words, I can pronounce and find the words there. But I usually skip this and I go directly to the interlinear, where I can also find the Greek language, but I've got a translation underneath it. But in this, either one of these, the Greek text or the interlinear, I can actually see the Greek word, and I can see the ending of the Greek word, and I can then compare it to different things. I mean, I can, and again, you could too. You can sound the word out, and you can pick out where the ending's at, and then that ending you see in a chart or diagram which way it's going, what tense, what mood it is. But also, there's books here that will actually come right out and tell you. I mean, you don't even need to know the Greek language. You can just grab a book and read; it'll tell you what it is. So let's try to go through some of those things and show you the different options.
I'll try to quit, you know, at a decent time tonight, and I'll try and lay these books out so you can come look at them. I've got samples of them in the framework book here, so you kind of see what the portion would look like in the book here. But, you know, and you may have them also, these books. Okay, the Greek text. The first thing, the Greek text. Scholars have worked through all the appropriate Greek manuscripts to produce the best Greek New Testament. And now it never gets easy. It never, I say, hold this up right here. Here's the Greek New Testament, you know, the text. It's like, but at the bottom of each of these pages, and you can't see it from there probably, but at the bottom of each of the pages, it talks about the manuscripts. What's it called? The apparatus. This is the bottom part, is called the apparatus, where it tells you where they got this information. Because there is not a Greek New Testament, as we've talked about before, laying in Jerusalem in some shrine somewhere. Let's go look at the original Greek New Testament the apostles wrote. They did. They wrote letters and sent them all across the Middle East. And then people made copies of them. The originals were lost, and they continued to copy as they went down into Egypt. They went up to the Byzantine Empire. They are somewhere in Caesarea. Some went to Rome. And I've got all these copies of the originals, but you don't have the originals. And by the time you get to Rome and Alexandria, some of the words have been slightly altered, or they may have dropped out. They may have double copied something. And now you're going to put them all together. They don't all just fit in a nice, perfect package. I mean, nothing, and we've talked about this before, it's not drastic. But again, saying I've got the Greek New Testament, That what has already happened is, before you even get to the Greek scholarship, someone has already gone through all of those manuscripts, sifted through them, and made decisions. This is not the word we're going to use. We're going to stick with this manuscript here. They're using manuscripts, but there's always manuscripts that are contradicting some of the things that are already in there. So when someone says, we don't even know where the Bible's at, there's somewhat of a truth to that. But then they understand, when you get right down to it, they're all saying basically the same thing. There's certain words that are altered. But nonetheless, that's found here in the apparatus at the bottom. This is the Greek New Testament. That's the first thing. Scholars have put this together. All right. That's the Greek New Testament. Next, the Greek-English interlinear. And that's what this is right here. We'll look at some of these things in the pages later. And what you've got is exactly on this column over here. On this page, I've got the Greek written out. And underneath it is a Greek or English translation of it. And the word. And it's not necessarily even NIV, King James, New American Standard over here. It's just the translation of the word. Over here on this particular book, I've got the King James in this column and the NIV in this other column. There's two, both translations are here. But this is the actual text right here. So this is the Greek text with the English. I would suggest this is nice to have. An interlinear here is nice to have. You can see the Greek words right there by with the English translation. The next thing is the Greek grammars. And again, just point this out to you very quickly. Here is the New Testament Greek, a beginning and intermediate grammar by Hewitt, James Hewitt. I sat in on a couple classes of him. He attended a Methodist church down in Tulsa, and he'd have evening classes like on a Thursday night. He'd have an evening class where he'd teach through his Greek. This is one of the Greek scholars in America. Just happened to be in Tulsa, lived there, and I'd go out at night and try and sit in on his Greek classes. And of course, I was busy working. I couldn't always make it, but I'd try to catch on a couple of his. I think it went to like three classes, and then that was it. But this is a Greek grammar. He teaches the Greek language in this right here at the beginning. That would be called a Greek grammar. There's many of these. If you want to go verse by verse or section by section and work your way through the Greek language. The Greek concordance. Let's see what we've got here. Here's the English concordance. Let's come over here. Okay, here we go. You know what a Strong's concordance is? That is, but then you've got to get, is it a King James or is it an NIV or New American Standard? And you can get yourself a King James, like a Strong's concordance, then have an NIV Bible, and the words aren't even the same. So there's one thing, and yeah, that's fine, you can go buy an NIV concordance. But you can also get a Greek concordance. And now this takes every Greek word, and I can look up the Greek word, and here's every mention of that Greek word in the Greek New Testament. Now what's unique about this is when you get into a Strong's concordance or any concordance in the English, they're going to line up the words, pair up the words or match the words with the same word that's translated. And when you get in there, you'll find out, and let me see if I can say this better. You'll have the word goat. I'm making this up. Goat. And you'll have all the reference of goat being used. Goat, goat, goat. Now, this is not even a real example. And all these, the Bible verse, all these are goats. Then over here, there'll be Strong's number, 1127. 1127. And then there's also 893, goat. 1127.
In the English Bible, all of these verses have the word goat in them. But these 1, 2, 3 are the same Greek word goat, but this is a different word for goat. It's just got translated goat. And it could be a big deal. So sometimes when you see people comparing verses, I've looked up all the verses that deal with goat. But when you actually get in there, it's like, this doesn't mean goat. This word could mean, you know, sheep, lamb, any, you know, type of animal that is similar to a goat. And this is maybe more of a scientific, would you understand? So in the English concordance, you may not notice that unless you look at the numbers. In a Greek, when I look up the word goat, it's going to have, it is the Greek word goat in all the same cases. And some of the verses that you're looking for would have a different word for goat, but you've got to find that other word in here, and then they'll be listed together. So this is now a concordance of the Greek New Testament. Does that make sense? Okay, I'm on shaky ground here, so a little nod every once in a while really fires me up. Okay. Here's a Strong's Concordance. Here's the Strong's Concordance. How many of you guys got Strong's Concordance? And this is just like, you know what it is. You've got your verses written over here, and I'm looking right here at this word I'm looking at right here, inhabitant. And I've got this column right here is inhabitant. Up here is inhabitants. Everywhere in both, now again, this is both Old and New Testament. So now you're going to have Hebrew and Greek words, and you got to be real careful when you start grabbing an Old Testament inhabitants and a New Testament inhabitants and saying, look, it's the same word. Well, first of all, it's not the same word. One's a Hebrew word, one's a Greek word. And they may indeed be saying the same thing, but they're not the same word. They can't be. They're two different languages. And that, I mean, it's just like having us saying, you know, the English and the Greek, it's the same word. It's, you know, it's hundreds of years apart sometimes. But nonetheless, you know, like Strong's Concordance, and it's useful in a variety of ways. But what's nice about it is Strong did go through and number everything. Every word's got a number. So if you don't, we'll say, this whole Greek thing, I'm confused, relax, just look at the number. We all know our numbers. And you can flip back in the back here, and they've got a Greek dictionary in the back. Did you know this? There's a Greek dictionary in the back. And so you're looking right here at a word. I'm looking at the word when. It's number 37. The word is 3752 in the Strong's Concordance. So I flip back here and find word 3752. And when I find 3752, boom, there I've got it. I've got the Greek word written out. I've got the transliteration of that word. And I've got a brief definition talking about, sometimes even about the etymology of the word. So now I'm now looking into the Greek. I don't even know Greek. All I know is that that word is, I can't even pronounce that word, but I know that word is this number, and that is the word used in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 10, or whatever. And there I have it right here. And at least anybody can do that with a Strong's Concordance. Next thing, that's the number 5, that's the English Concordance. I mentioned the Strong's. The Greek lexicon. A Greek lexicon is a dictionary, but also provides examples of how the word was used in other writings. So example right here. Here is a Greek Thayer's lexicon. It's an old one. There are better lexicons. Better, I say, because the recent papyri, some of these things come out of the 1800s. Because scholarship, it has to process all this information. And so a discovery today, for example, if they discovered a find of some ancient Greek writings today, and it really opened up a meaning of some word meanings and some understanding, it wouldn't show up. It's not in any of my books. When's it going to show up? It's going to take 10, 15, 20, 30 years for it to show up in actual academic books. And so the same thing. Thayer's is an old lexicon. It's good, it's old, but there's many papyri that have been found in the 1900s that reveal things or shed light on the Greek language that aren't in Thayer's. But also in here, as we look at a word right here, I can look up, again, this particular one is keyed to Strong. So if I find the number, I can actually go right here and look it up. I can go right into this Greek lexicon. Let me read the definition of a lexicon. It's a dictionary, but it also provides examples of how the word was used in other writings written during the time of the New Testament. The entry in the lexicon will cite writers such as Josephus, Herodian, Tacitus, Socrates, and hundreds more to give a full sense of the meaning of what the word meant to those who heard it 2,000 years ago. Newer lexicons will also cite examples of the papyri in recent manuscript discoveries. And again, sometimes that's more important than quoting Homer, who wrote 700 B.C. Homer wrote 700 years before Paul was using that word. Well, Homer says this about the word. Well, that may mean something, but you really want to find out what did it say in the papyri that were being written during the time of the New Testament. That's how the people heard the word. Paul wasn't. That's the thing they found out when they got into the papyri. It's Koine Greek. It's not ancient. It's not the Greek of classical Greek. Paul did not write in classical Greek. This is huge. You really can't go back to Homer and say, well, this is how Homer used it in his writings, because 700 years later, Paul's using it. It may be the same thing, but chances are it may not be. So the papyri really shed light exactly this is how they read it in the paper that morning when Paul wrote his letter that afternoon. That's a lexicon. Okay, moving on, the Greek dictionary. A Greek dictionary is just exactly that, a Greek dictionary. It gives you the meaning. I've got a couple that are very, I didn't grab them, but a very thin one. You look the word up, it's just got like a one or two word definition, very simple. But when you come to words like anthropos or apostolos, or something, it's like, what does that word mean? I know that word. Oh, apostle. It means apostle, or it means man or something. It's like, boom, you can get the real clear definition. Not a big history of it. But that's if I'm talking about a thin, just a little dictionary like you might take on a trip somewhere. It's like, what does this word mean? It means food, you know. But we also have, for example, this is called the Theological Dictionary of the New Testament. And it's written by Kittles. The set is called Kittles. And it's a 10-volume set. It is a theological dictionary. It doesn't just give you one word for what this word means. For example, I'm going to see if I can find agape. I should have looked this up here for you earlier. Agape. Engloss. Here we go. There we go. Here's agape. We're still in agape right here. Agathos, agape. Right in here we go. The word agape means love. In a simple dictionary, agape, love. The theological dictionary, here you go. These pages are describing the word agape. Meaning, they're going through all the theology, how it was used in the Septuagint, how it was used in Homer's writing, how it was used in the papyri, all the different meaning, how the Jews used the word. And then you're going to study for your sermon on Sunday. You could kill yourself trying to get ready for a sermon on Sunday, or I want to read everything written about the word agape. Not by Sunday you won't. And then if you're ready, and if you do get it done, who's going to want to hear it? I mean, you understand? And I fall in that trap sometimes too. It's like, and this word means, it's like, you've lost us, we don't even care, we are no longer communicating. So in other words, this is, again, a theological dictionary. It's a 10-volume set, and it covers every word in the Greek. You'll look it up, and it's just, what's nice about this, and seriously, I don't look up every word, every verse in these, but when you hit that verse, it's like, you kind of don't know what to do with it, or someone's saying something, and someone else is saying something else, you go here, and it gives you a little more light. And this is supposed to be exegetical work, meaning it's supposed to be telling you what the word means in the context, not telling you what your church's theology is about that word. You understand the difference? We want this to speak to us, and then we'll process it. You need to be careful that you're not getting into someone reading their thoughts into it. And a good Greek scholar tries to stay in that language and then bring it out for you to just set it on the shelf right there. And he's serving people that aren't even of his own denomination, you know, his own viewpoint of theology. But he's sitting on the shelf saying, this is what the word means. Do with it what you want to. He's not trying to force feed you. That's what a pastor does. I mean, me too. You know, have you understood? This is what the word means. Don't ask any questions. Going on, what else we got here? Greek dictionary, Greek reference sets. Okay, I brought two along, and I've got several sets. This is a 4-volume set by Wiest. And he'll go through, like, for example, I'm looking right here at chapter 7 of Romans. He starts in chapter 7, verse 1, and he covers the verse right here. And what he's doing right here is he's going through talking about the Greek words in there and how they mean. And just explodes the words. Very good. Wiest is very good. A lot of fun. Here's another one by Nicole Robertson. Nicole. And he's got a 5-volume set. He does the same thing. And this actually has the Greek text up here. And with a little bit of apparatus here, and then some discussion. Then it's discussion of the words down here. And again, this is nice to have. So I've got several of these on my shelf. You get that verse, you grab Wiest, you grab Nicole, you grab these different authors, and you read through them. And it's like, if they're all saying the same thing, pretty good deal. I mean, you're pretty solid. And that's why a lot of things when I teach Greek, it's not like, wow, how did you know that? I read it here. You see what I'm saying? It's like, wow, he knows so much about the Bible. It's like, well, this is what this guy said, and I just remembered what he said.
And again, you can see the error in that if you start following somebody who doesn't know what they're talking about. That's why it's nice to have several other authors. This is called the Greek New Testament Analyzed. And all this is, it's a dummy version, I guess I can call it, of all the Greek, the mood, the tense, the voice, all just written out for you. You find the word. If you can read the Greek word, you find the Greek word. It's alphabetized, you find it, and it will tell you. It's used three times. It's the nominative, masculine, singular, and then tells you that it's one of this, it's a root from this, the root is this word here. It tells you all of it right there, just so fast. You don't have to know anything about the endings of the word. You just look it up and read it, and it tells it to you. That's kind of nice. I use that frequently. And this is probably my favorite book right here. It's called The Linguistic Key. It's by Cleon Rogers Jr. and Cleon Rogers III. So it must have been a Cleon Rogers I. And what this is right here, and I'll try to get you a chance to explain this to you better. You look up a verse. For example, looking at Acts 15. There's verse 1. And it's got all the major Greek words written here. And it tells you all about it. For example, aorist, active, participle. And it tells you more about the word. This is a great... If I would advise any book, this is the book to get. Because it just takes you right into the verse. It doesn't tell you all... A lot of those Greek words you don't need to know. It's like, it's pretty clear. The word like agape, it means love. You can study it all you want to, but it means love. But some of these words, it gets in there into the verbs, and it starts to explain them to you in a way that only this kind of a book can do it. And it's like the shortcut. I use this a lot. Here's a neat book. Here's a Strong's Concordance combined with Vines. I haven't even mentioned Vines Dictionary. Vines Dictionary is the same thing. This has got a combination of Strong's and Vines in it. And that's enough of that. Let's turn the page. 354, 355, what I've got there, I've got the same exact things, the Greek grammars, the Greek concordance, the Greek English concordance, and I've got several examples, like for example on page 355 where it says Greek lexicon, I've got two of them written there. I've got Thayer's written down, that's the one I showed you, and then one called BDAG, or officially the Greek English lexicon of the New Testament and other early Christian literature. That one includes the papyri. Or the Greek dictionaries, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Greek dictionaries listed. I showed you just one of them. So those are just some examples. Go to page 357. The study. I'm going to show you two more things, I think, tonight. I want to talk a little bit about this thing called ICE. I-C-E. And I learned this from, you know, how you learn from different people. I learned this from a pastor, a legendary pastor that I was familiar with. And this is how he taught. He always talked about ICE. And this really hit home for me. I think it makes sense to you also. ICE, the I in ICE means isogogics. And it's the second paragraph on that page. This is basically studying the scriptures in the time that they were written. Isogogical. It means the historical setting. Meaning you need to know how the people heard the word or the letter when they received it. You've got to know about the history of the city. You've got to know about the culture. You've got to know about what the idioms that were used in the book of the Bible, how it was heard by those first century hearers, the historical background. Again, not to be blasphemous or say that God is dead, but the Bible wasn't written to you. It was written to first century Christians. So, I mean, as a spirit, yes, it speaks to me. The Spirit is alive. He's moving through the Word. He's speaking to me. But it's language. It's literature. It was written to the first century. So how did they hear it? You've got to put it in that context, and then the Spirit can truly speak to you. Do you understand what I'm saying? You can't read it when it says, you can't put it in the context of 2011. Because the way the words were used, the settings that were in, it wasn't 2011, it was the first century AD. So you can't read it like it was written to you by Paul, it was written in the first century. Once you understand the isagogical setting, once you understand the historical setting, now God can speak the truth to you. I believe God's speaking to you through the Word, but you can't read it as if that letter of the Philippians was written to you. Because it wasn't written to you, it was written to people, it wasn't even written to the Christians in Jerusalem. And you can find certain things in there. As Paul writes to different people, he'll talk to the Corinthians one way, but he talks to the Philippians another way, because he's addressing his audience. If I send out an email today, and I send an email to a teacher down the hallway, and I send an email to my wife, and I got those two emails mixed up, would I have a problem? Yes, because I was sending one to my wife and one to another teacher. And I wasn't thinking the same thing.
And the same thing, you read the New Testament like it was written to you and just say, well, I'm going to discount the eisegetical. You're going to have the same or worse problems than what I would have if I sent my wife's email to a teacher down the hallway. Okay, and you know what I mean. Numbers 2, the second one, categorical. You need to teach these things categorically. A verse is never set by itself isolated. You're going, this would be considered the theology, the categorizing of it. It's another way of saying it. You're going to take all the verses about the resurrection. When you read a verse about the resurrection, you can't just read that verse. You've got to have an understanding of all the verses dealing with resurrection and put them all together and organize them. Because just like when you talk about, if I talk about a certain, I'm trying to think of a situation on the top of my head, and you only hear me say one, okay, talk about my sons. You hear me say, yesterday in church, for example, I said this on the, you listen to the sermon, listen to the video or something. But for example, I thought after I got done doing it on the way home, I thought that people could misunderstand that. But Zach said 2 weeks before in church, I said, well, how was that? He goes, Dad, you kept saying the same thing over and over and over again. And so I said, well, so he didn't come to church today. He's looking for a different church. And so it's kind of like, okay, boom, I said that about my son Zach. He's looking for a different church. He criticized my sermon on the way home. You leave that sit there, it's like, okay, I don't really got trouble with Zach. He's not even coming to church. He's looking for a different church. And it's like, well, no, you need to put all of the verses about me and my son Zach in context and then come to a conclusion. And you understand, if you took that one verse, this is what Galen said about Zach, and Zach said about Galen that he doesn't like listening to his dad preach, he's just said the same thing over and over and over again, and so now he's not coming to church anymore. It's like, okay, if you want to go with that, you can, and make your doctrine on that, but let's look at everything else that has been said about Galen and Zach before we come to that conclusion. Indeed, that's a true statement, but it needs to be balanced, and that is, you need to study things historically. You need to study things categorically and then exegetical. And here we go. If you look in the third paragraph, exegesis. It has nothing to do with Jesus, Jesus Christ. It has nothing. What is exegesis? What are you doing? What are we doing with Jesus now? Nothing. It's nothing. Ek means out of. It's a preposition. Ek, written like this or written like this. Ek, and then I think it's somewhere in here. It looks in the third line. Ek ago. Ek, ago in the Greek. You see right there, epsilon, cap.